Some of them were killed and others maimed. In all, 17 men died. Since then, the place has been called Stasfeld and the Valley Deladau. Uni supported Jotov, and the brothers supported Carl and Thorsten.
Hey, what are you doing, John?
I'm just starting in the middle of things. I thought we should embrace the madness.
A little carpe insanium?
Something like that, yeah.
All right, well, do you want to start for real now, or are we committing to this nonsense?
Well, let me answer that by saying, welcome to Saga Thing, where we're putting the sagas of the Icelanders on trial. I'm John.
Hey, I'm Andy. And in each episode of this podcast, I'm excited. We read a saga, and then we talk about it a bit, and sometimes we talk about it a lot. And This is kind of our third episode covering Svartala Saga. The Saga of the Tumultuous Valley.
Still a good name.
Still a good name. It's a very good name. But is it a good saga?
Are you asking me, or is this a way of introducing you telling me?
No, it's just a question that I think we should keep in front of us as we deal with this story. Because Up to now, we've been dealing with a pretty standard and, I think, enjoyable family saga. But as your opening non sequitur made clear, this saga has gone a little off kilter. Where are we? What's going on?
Okay, first of all, I don't think you can technically have an opening non sequitur. Second, you okay, Andy? You sound a little bit off kilter yourself.
Ah, well, yeah, prepping for this episode has aged me, John, but otherwise I'm fine.
Yeah, it'll do that. Do you have something to drink?
Well,
I think we're going to both need something to drink tonight, Andy.
Well, I do. I have a Godhopper India Pale Ale by Grind City Brewing Company from Memphis.
Oh,
that's what I'm drinking tonight. Yeah.
Excellent. Good for you. Personally, I'm rehydrating with a coffee old fashioned. Thought I might need the caffeine.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So what do you think, John? Do we want to turn to this saga?
Well, I mean, we could do that, but there's going to be a problem in a minute.
Exactly 1 minute?
Yeah, just about. The problem is this isn't a regular episode of the podcast.
No, it is. We literally just said hello and introduced and everything.
Andy, the thing is, we're not talking about the saga's plot this time.
We're not? I mean, we're not. We are not.
No. Because I've checked the forecast, Andy, and it's dark. It's dark and stormy, with a 100% chance of manuscript studies.
Yeah, but not just that, right? We've got a story to tell.
Look, I wish I could tell you, Andy, that we're going to be talking about the next part of the saga. I wish I could tell you that. But saga scholarship is no fairy tale world. And we've got a big hole right through the middle of this story that we've got to deal with.
All right, Red. Listen, if you're actually committing to listening to this episode, first, thank you. I hope you came prepared because we're going to have to start with a bit of a leap of faith into the world of manuscript studies.
A leap of faith, yeah. Really?
And I hope that's two thunderclaps within like 5 minutes, just for the heck of it, just for the listeners.
Well, I warned you. I warned you the forecast was gloomy.
Yeah. I mean, it is going to be an interesting conversation. To us, now whether it's interesting to anyone else, I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, the good news is that if you survive listening to this, the next episode will introduce a bunch of new people, including a child who might be one of the worst people in all of saga literature. Oh, and a guy breaks a comb. So, you know, good stuff coming up.
Do you ever think about how ridiculous it is that people listen to this podcast?
Embrace the darkness, Andy. Give it a little cuddle.
Yeah, that's why we're such close friends, John.
Part 6, The Big Lacuna.
Surf's up, Johnny!
Yes, the surf is indeed up. Somewhere out there. But here at Saga Thing, we're talking about the Big Lacuna, not the Big Kahuna.
Oh. Why am I wearing swim trunks?
That's a very good question I was going to ask.
All right, well, I guess I'm just going to put away this surf wax then.
Oh, the unfortunately named Sex Wax. No, you shan't be needing that.
What about my...
No, you don't. You can put away the beach blanket and the bingo cards, too.
No beach blanket bingo, then?
I feel like you're a very confused man right now.
All right. Well, I will stop wiggling my hips, if that's the way...
Well, no. Don't stop doing that. I'm enjoying that.
Oh, you devil.
Well, let's start with the obvious, Andy. With apologies to Duke Kahanamoku and Frankie Avalon and really the entire state of Hawaii, the big lacuna in Svartalo Saga is a problem.
Yeah.
We're essentially being forced to reset all of our expectations for a coherent narrative.
Is that obvious, though? I mean, we've dealt with lacunae before, and the narrative continued more or less naturally when that happens.
Yes, but why is that?
Well, I mean, it depends on the saga, doesn't it?
Sure, okay.
So, like, in an ideal world, we tend to fill in the missing information from other contemporary sources or maybe other versions of the manuscript. So, if we look at False Brother Saga, the Saga of the Sworn Brothers, which we covered in episode 33 of this podcast, the narrative is occasionally disrupted, and there are even a couple of episodes that don't appear in the story but do appear in other sagas.
Right. This is the saga that included the cameo from Grettir Asmundarson.
That's right, yeah. There's a fuller version of that story in Grettir Saga, but we were able to insert it into our discussion pretty easily. So even if a saga manuscript is missing some bits, we can sometimes stitch together what's missing from these other sources.
Right. And of course, Lanama Book, the Book of Settlements, is often really useful for that as well.
Yeah. And in other cases, a saga might have a gap that really just doesn't affect our ability to follow the narrative at all. Maybe a sentence or a scene is lost, but the narrative flow isn't especially affected.
Right. And we saw that in our last episode with the Little Lacuna.
Right. Yeah. The duel with Moldy the Half-Berserk and its aftermath is pretty much lost. But anyone with a vague sense of saga form can fill in that gap and pick up again where Thorstein and Jarl Heroth are discussing his reward, which is what we saw.
Right. Well, but we have had one example of a manuscript gap that just stopped the narrative cold.
Yeah. I wondered if you remembered this one. I was thinking about it, but I had to look it up myself.
Vulpenfjärðingasaga, right?
Vulpenfjärðingasaga.
The one with the lacuna so disrupting that we awarded the manuscript damage best bloodshed.
It was a long time ago, and that feels like it was like three beers and some cocktails kind of a decision.
Hey, drunk or sober, the saga thing is binding.
Mm-hmm.
So usually when you find a break in a manuscript, there's some material culture explanation. Mm-hmm. Whether that's physical damage to the document, missing pages, or a scribal error, or whatever else might happen to the text over hundreds of years.
Like wormholes.
Like wormholes, yeah. Not the sci-fi kind, though.
No, we're talking about bookworms. Hmm?
And not the well-read kind.
The well-fed kind is what we're talking about.
Cute.
This is a good joke, right?
It's important that you believe.
I liked it. Now, medieval manuscript pages are typically made from vellum, which is processed animal skin. This skin contains keratin, which is an attractive food source for things like woodworms, which is the larval stage for wood-boring beetles.
Right, and that keratin is also in the leather binding and in the glue used to make books. Mm-hmm. So a medieval library is a potential smorgasbord, a utopia for wood-boring beetles and moths looking for a place to lay eggs.
Yeah, and when those eggs hatch, boom, the larvae can eat a hole straight through a manuscript and consume some pretty important words along the way, often obscuring the meaning of important lines of text.
Right, and that brings up a famous Exeter book riddle.
Yes. I use this one in my class all the time. I believe it goes, Molte word frat, me that tukte ratliche word, tha ich that wunder je fragen, that se worm for swerk, where jed sumes, theof in thustro, thrum fast nequide, on das strongen stadel, staljest ne huas wikte de glera, the hetham wordum swelk.
Very nice. I actually do this with my students too. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's the Old English version. In modern English, can I do the modern English?
I think the Old English should be good enough for most people, but if you want to, go ahead.
Just in case. A moth ate words. A marvelous fate, it seemed to me, when I heard of that wonder that a worm could swallow some man's song, a thief in the dark, tales of glory and their firm foundation. The thieving guest was none the wiser, for swallowing those words.
That's good stuff. I really like that. This bookworm eating through the book, but not getting any wiser for consuming those words.
I've known some people like that.
Me too.
But we're getting distracted here. I'll attempt to steer us back onto course. In most cases, whether it's a wormhole or a damaged passage or even a missing couple of pages, the narrative itself picks up and continues, and the job of an editor or a reader is just to try to fill in that blank with a logical assumption. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the big lacuna in Svartdala's saga, the problem is that the lacuna doesn't just interrupt the narrative, it completely disrupts it. So we left off in Sweden with Thorsten Thorgnarsson, he just married an earl's daughter named Ingebjörg, mm-hmm. and fathered a son named Thorolf, which was named for his late brother.
Yeah, pretty standard stuff for a hero, I'd say.
Uh-huh, yeah. Yeah, I can see why you'd think that. A guy known for questionable behavior marries an accomplished woman with Swedish ancestry. Hmm. Yeah, I can see why you would think that makes sense.
You better stop. My ears are burning, John.
But the problem is the story just stops dead at that point.
It does. Here's exactly where it stops again, in case you missed it last time. In the text, Thorstein says, "I have one request, sir, that if I send you any sons that I have with your daughter, they will inherit your land and wealth after your death." The earl then said that it would be as he desired.
And then nothing.
Yeah.
The story picks up again with what I read at the start of this episode.
So can you read that again just to highlight how different everything suddenly is?
Right. Okay. So we just left off with Thorsten talking to his father-in-law. And now the manuscript picks up with, "Some of them were killed and others maimed. In all, 17 men died. Since then, the place has been called Safsholt, and the valley Deldedal. Uni supported Jotolf, and the brothers supported Karl and Thorsten, because Uni was as closely related to Jotolf as the brothers were to Thorsten."
Yeah, so we pick up in a new country with a Thorstein that may or may not be the same one that we just left in a new feud, and we're picking up the story in media res, which is a classy lit crit term that we don't get to use very often with the sagas.
It's true, but although now that I think about it, In Media Res would have been a good name for our saga briefs.
In the middle of things. It works because saga briefs are in the middle of sagas most often.
In the middle of things.
Yeah, that's right.
I've always thought saga briefs sounds like we're talking about epic underwear.
There's a good advertising opportunity in there somewhere.
Sure, yeah. That's always been my dream of a second career is selling underwear. Yeah.
Look, Ma, we made it.
I always wanted to be the purple grapes in Fruit of the Loom. Now, the big lacuna doesn't make things easy for anyone trying to appreciate Svartdala's.
No. I mean, this isn't a wormhole. This missing portion of the narrative is so substantial that it's a bit of a challenge to fill in with any degree of accuracy, though some have tried.
Right. So let's take stock for a moment here. What we have is a saga that only survives as a post-medieval paper manuscript from maybe 1700. It's broken into by a large gap, and there's also a bit surviving from a vellum manuscript from about 300 years earlier. And then there's this other bit that we're going to talk about later that may or may not even be legitimate. So for starters, we're dealing with a text that's at least partly centuries away from legitimate classical age writing. And the later stuff has some linguistic peculiarities that indicate that we're working from material that is self-consciously archaizing in its writing, and it's only partially succeeding.
Yeah, and even beyond the lacuna gap, we're dealing with a literary game of telephone with one or more writers who may be intentionally speaking in a funny historical accent.
Exactly, yeah. And we can put up some articles from Peter Foote and Jonas Christensen that go into some more detail about that. But that's the 10-cent version.
Yeah, and then there's a whole different set of possibilities created by the Rask manuscript version of the saga, which is really interesting.
Yeah. I don't know how far down this particular hole we want to spelunk, but yes.
I mean, we're dedicating a whole episode to the big lacuna, but let's give a brief version of the Rask story, shall we? There's an 18th, 19th century Danish scholar that we've talked about once or twice on the podcast and in some saga briefs. His name is Rasmus Rask.
Right. And if his name sounds slightly familiar, it might be because you spent too much time reading about early saga scholarship.
Uh-huh.
Or it might be because his work on phonological mutation in Germanic languages was later completed by Jacob Grimm. And it's sometimes called the Rask-Grimm Law.
Well, you just made like six people very happy.
Shout out to my History of English students.
So Rask was an active force in early saga studies, and he inserted himself into the problem of Svarfdala saga's missing bits when he turned up a copy of the missing passages during a trip to Iceland around the year 1815.
Okay, so we're going that far into it. Okay.
I mean, that's if you want to understand the Rask question, then that's where you got to go. So
carry on.
For context, Rask was a highly regarded scholar of Scandinavian literature and historical culture back when those were roughly the same subject. And he's one of the founders of the Icelandic Literary Society. That's an organization that publishes the official foreign read editions of the sagas that indeed everything that we're working with is based on.
Yeah. So when Rask spoke, he spoke with authority when it came to the sagas.
Absolutely.
And until Rask's trip to Iceland, Svarfdal was just missing some bits, as far as anyone knew. Mm-hmm. Thordo Gudmundsson's introduction in 1830 laments, two of the major gaps are in chapters 9 and 10, and a lot has fallen out in those places.
Right. That's where we find ourselves in the story right now.
That's the spot. Mm-hmm.
So Rask spends his time in Iceland collecting manuscripts and kind of sifting through them, buying them when he can, making copies when he can't. And along the way, he finds a story that plugs the gap in the saga, the big lacuna, the one we're dealing with right now. And like a lot of scholars, Rask was a little idiosyncratic.
How dare you, sir?
Oh, don't worry. It's going to be fine. So anyway, Rask's manuscripts ended up just getting numbers. So this one is Rask 37. And it was considered pretty authoritative for a long while, and it's even used in some spots to plug the holes in the foreign read version of the saga.
Right. It's not especially reliable, though.
In which sense?
Well, its dating is questionable for a start. It's definitely much more recent than the saga itself.
Sure, yeah. This is a problem of a lot of early work on medieval literature. Scholars were more casual about plugging gaps in the material or making editorial decisions on the basis of guesswork and best-case scenarios, so.
Right. It's the golden age of making stuff up.
Sometimes very much so. which I find really fascinating. It's one of the things that I've spent some time kind of digging through. Why we make the assumptions or assertions about text that we do. Oftentimes, if you dig deep, it's based on some 18th, 19th century assertion that a scholar made with very little support.
And I'll give a plug because you're not going to, but if maybe we can put a link up in the show notes. But Andy actually has an article about Beowulf that deals with this exact subject, and it's worth reading. It's a really interesting study of the history of notes on the poem.
Well, I don't know about that. in this case, Rask's text, which is his copy of the version that he found, has grammatical features that indicate its more recent creation. It's newer, right? It's distant from the writing of the saga itself. And it makes pretty significant use of Landnámabók, which is the settlements book, for details, even when those details are actually different from the rest of Svarfdala saga.
Right. Right, and you're jumping ahead on me because I've already marked our spot in the settlements book. Mm-hmm. We'll get to that later.
Yeah, we will. Now, as we'll see, the similarities are significant, obviously, but it sounds almost like what we were talking about. Yet another version of this story with its own focal points and its own agenda.
Agreed, but hang on for a second. I want to circle back to the Rask document.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
I have a serious question for you.
Oh, a serious question, because we've been just all jocularity so far.
Well, how confident should we be that Rask didn't write the discovered manuscript himself?
So you mean, did he just make it up?
Well, yes. I'm not necessarily saying there was any deliberate malfeasance going on, but we are talking about 19th century scholarship here. Right? Finding creative solutions to textual problems wasn't really frowned upon the way it is now. Scholars were willing to do things like trim physical manuscripts, reorder their pages, literally cut and paste leaves into manuscripts. Right? There wasn't a lot that was beyond the pale. Quite a few people, noted scholars, even made scrapbooks for themselves by slicing out the prettiest pages from different manuscripts. Mm-hmm. Right. So the Auchinleck manuscript, for example, this hugely important collection of Middle English verse, was cut to pieces because nearly all the illuminations have been chopped out of it by thieves and collectors.
Well, first of all, they're very pretty. And second of all...
Sure. Well, not anymore they aren't. I'm sure they were very pretty.
It was a different time. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to say that that sort of thing doesn't happen anymore. I would say it happens less, but there are still people who buy and cut up manuscripts to sell piecemeal. In the 19th century, just about everything historical was up for grabs. This was a time when visitors to Stonehenge were actually allowed to rent chisels to take a chunk home for the mantelpiece.
That's right.
It's probably not going to happen today, but...
Yep. I mean, you could try, but...
It won't go well.
Yeah, and it was definitely a time when proposed emendations could become an accepted part of an edition or a translation pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the interesting things about that is you could make an emendation, put it into a book, an edition, and once it's in the edition, it becomes kind of the standard because it's the only edition available, right?
Right, right. Yeah, a lot of the texts do this where little bits get added or subtracted, right? You know, I spent time in grad school studying a poem called Dame Cerith. Which for its first century was published without the final verse because it was deemed too crude for a scholarly audience.
Yeah. Yeah. And here we are talking about Rasmus Rask, brilliant, important scholar. But John, this is the same guy who declared that Dighton Rock in Massachusetts was probably carved by Thorfinn Karlsefni back in the 11th century.
Yeah.
That was just on the strength of a drawing by one of his own students. So... it's a fair question to ask, I think, if Rasmus Rask might have made this up or made some assumptions that wouldn't have held today.
Right, but do we have an answer? Mm. I mean, I know where I am on this. If this were a game of Clue, that's Cluedo for those of you not in North America. If this were Clue, I'm ready to suspect Rask, but not to accuse
him. I see.
I really haven't done the homework to be definite. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, it's not impossible that Rask found the missing piece of the manuscript. I mean, we seem to find a lost manuscript every year, and we report on it at Christmas time somehow.
Yeah, the Viking Age origins of Twas the Night Before Christmas, the saga of, what, Gudmund the Grunch? What, is that what we named it eventually?
Yeah. No, we didn't recently, name it that. That's what it's called in the manuscript that we found.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, it is. Of course. And just recently we discovered... that spliced together poem about the Yule lights.
Exactly. See, so it does happen that someone finds these things.
But Andy, we've been singularly fortunate in our searches for lost manuscripts with a vaguely Christmas theme.
Almost suspiciously so. But perhaps Rasmus was too.
Uh-huh.
So, but honestly.
Oh, are you on a first name basis? You and Rasmus?
Yes. But without further research... I really can't say one way or the other, like you. I have to admit I'm suspicious. I'm hoping maybe one of our listeners might know a little more about this issue or have access to some materials that are unavailable to us here in the States. I'm looking at you, Kauri Tolinius, for some help here.
So we're just name calling people who we want to do our work for us now.
Well, Kauri's pretty good at this kind of stuff.
I know. Well, the important thing is we've made the situation slightly more confusing than it already was.
Yeah.
Our work here is done.
So where does all this leave us?
I mean, it seems like there isn't a lot of reason to be confident that any of the different pieces of the story were originally part of the same whole.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
All the parts seem to be telling the same story, roughly, but... then again, so do the two Greenlander sagas, and those two stories are very, very different.
Yeah, it's not a bad analogy, actually, but this story is even more fundamentally different after the Lacuna.
Yeah, even beyond the narrative shift to new characters and a new time and place, there are just stylistic changes that reflect the difference between, say, medieval and later post-classical preferences. Régis Boyer argues that the writing becomes... heavy and awkward after the gap.
So that's a post-classical preference to have heavy and awkward writing?
Heavy and awkward, yes. Yeah, yeah. As opposed to the nimble, light writing of the Middle Ages.
Yeah, well, he ain't wrong. Remember, Jonas Christensen called Svarfdalar saga one of the greatest oddities among the sagas of Icelanders. He argues that it existed in a different form in the 13th century that doesn't survive today. Then it was rewritten in the 14th century in, as he puts it, an extravagant style. But even that version barely survives in a fragmentary manuscript from the 15th century.
Yeah.
So chapters 1 to 10, the material that we covered in our first two episodes, represent that 14th century rewrite. And then the question is, who wrote the material that we're about to cover? What happens after the Lacuna?
Well, and when did they write
exactly? So Christensen suspects that maybe it's a much later reviser rather than an earlier one, possibly working from a memory of the 13th century original, but lacking the skill to execute the thing properly.
Well, whether it's from memory or not, it's probably fair to say that this reviser or author had some trouble pulling this narrative together into a cohesive whole.
Yeah, but we're agreed, right, that this is an entirely different version of the saga that we started with.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, because it just doesn't feel like the same text at all. Once we get to Iceland, you'll find that the style, the tone, characterizations, themes, and even the emphases, they all suggest the hand of a different author, one who's trying to piece together a living, breathing story from the bits and pieces that are available to him or that he can remember. But like Christensen says, he's not quite up to the task, at least not at first.
Well, and may very well have different predilections as a writer from the original author as well. So this, maybe this author's succeeding at doing what they want, and we just don't much care for what they want. But it's not hard to come to the conclusion that this, I mean, what we're reading, that this is the result of more than one version of this saga being put together to try to stitch a kind of Frankenstein saga out of broken parts. And I think ultimately that's my read. This is a Frankensaga, and we're going to have to essentially start over at the neck bolts. what do you think, Eddie?
Yeah, I agree. And I guess the first question we have to tackle is who the hell these people are in this opening of the next part of the saga.
Right. So, and so this is just, at this point, we're just going to kind of give you a little bit of a preview of what's going to be coming up in the next episode. The main players that we're introduced to as the saga picks back up are a man named Jotolf, who seems to be the leading chieftain and landholder in the valley, and then Thorsten the Tumultuous and his son Karl the Red.
Yes, yes. But who is this Thorstein the Tumultuous? Is it the same Thorstein that we've been traveling with through chapters 1 to 10? Or is this his son? Or is it someone else entirely?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, if we look at what's happening just before the big Lacuna, Thorsten Thorgnason has married Ingebjörg, and they've got that son, Thorolf. They set sail, I'm guessing, for Thorsten's home in Norway.
Yeah, that's correct. And then we're left to theorize on who exactly this Thorsten is and how he came to be in Iceland. I mean, as we've said, the gap left by the big Lacuna is so large that any attempts to flesh it out like we did for the duel with Moldi, they really can only be guesswork unless you find some missing manuscript pages.
Right. But we do have some options. Like we said earlier, when filling these kinds of gaps, we can look to other sources, other versions of the story. We can also use what we know about sagas and how they're written to fill in some of the gaps just by following the formulas.
Sure. Yeah. And like we said, we have options. Despite the doom and gloom approach we've been taking so far in this conversation, there are options.
Right. But ultimately, our options are very similar to what we were just accusing Rask of doing, which is to kind of, you know, fly by the seat of our pants and make our best guess.
Yes.
So, for example, we know that Svartdala saga existed in the 13th century because Sturla Thordason mentions it in the Lenelamok.
Yes.
I won't read the whole entry for Svartdala here, but there is some information there that informs several aspects of what we're going to see happening in the saga from this point forward.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that short section of Landnámabók, and it's book 3, chapter 13, if you're looking for it, it's all about laying out the origins of Svartdala saga. So, John, you have your Landnámabók there, I see. What does it have to say about this Thorstein? Who is he?
Yeah, I do have it, but I'm not sure it's that helpful, to be honest. It says, there was a man named Thorstein Svarthof, the son of Rauð Cradle in Namadal. He married Hild, the daughter of Thrain, the Black Giant. Thorstein went to Iceland and settled Svarthofsdal by the council of Helgi. That's Helgi the Lean. His children, Thorstein's children, were Karl the Red, who dwelt at Karl's River, and Gudrun, whom Hafthor the Viking had for wife. Their children were Clawfy and Groa, whom Gris Merryheart had for wife.
Hmm. Okay. I recognize several of those names, having read the saga. We got Thorstein, Carl the Red, Gris, and Clawfy. They're all in the saga as we go forward.
Yep. Yeah, and we'll introduce them all shortly ahead. And then I can't say shortly. Yeah, and we'll introduce them all in the next episode, assuming we can ever get out of this damn lacuna.
It's so deep. But the Thorstein of our saga is not the son of Rauth Cradle from Naumadal. Mm-hmm. And he's not, to my knowledge, married to the daughter of Thrain the Black Giant, which is a really interesting name, by the way.
Yeah, it is. There's some great nicknames in this chapter.
And this Clawfy and Groa, who is going to have, Groa is going to have a different name in our saga. They're most certainly not Thorstein's grandchildren in this saga.
No.
So, no, that you're right. That wasn't very helpful at all.
Sorry.
Fortunately, Rasmus Rask found those missing pages of the manuscript while he was gallivanting around Iceland, and he has filled it in for us quite nicely.
Sure he has. So we've already covered our suspicions. We don't have to rehash them. But according to Rask, what really happened in this saga?
Well, quite a lot, actually. According to Rask, Chapter 10 ends with Thorstein and Ingibjorg heading back to Thorgnir's farm in Norway. So he goes home to his father and takes over the farm, and he runs it well. And eventually Thorgnir dies of old age, but he dies full of pride in the man that his son has become.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to have closure on that issue, but it does somewhat fly in the face of Thorgnir's personality, as we've known it to this point.
No, he's been slowly building that pride. I think that
very
I think
slowly.
It's earned. I think it's earned. Now, along the way, Thorstein and Ingibjorg have another son who they call Carl the Red, and they have a daughter called either Gudrun or Thorarna. It's unclear. And then in chapter 11, or maybe they have two daughters. I don't know. I don't have that manuscript, so I can't see exactly. But this is the report of it, right?
Right.
So in chapter 11, Ingibjorg gets sick and she dies. And that's the moment when Harald Fairhair starts causing trouble in Norway.
Hey.
So rather than submit to this authoritarian king and give him money and loyalty, Thorstein prepares to join the exodus of noble Norwegian men to Iceland. But his son Thorolf, a grown man by that time, heads back to Sweden, where he takes over for his grandfather, Jarl Heroth, who dies quickly after he gets there.
Right. I do like this, because we did have hints of this kind of thing being possible. If this isn't the real thing, then Rask is at least doing a convincing job of following the saga formula and following on the hints that are dropped earlier in the story about how Thorstein's tale should play out.
Yes, I agree. So Thorstein and his son, Carl the Red, they are away from home getting things ready to go to Iceland, packing the ship or whatever, away from their property, when a large Viking called Hafthor Snækol, that's Snake Caller, shows up. And John, he's the son of the dastardly Ljot the Pale.
Of course.
And he steals a bunch of property and abducts Thorstein's daughter, Gudrun or Thorarna, and when Thorstein and Carl get home, well, there's no sign of Thorarna or her Viking captor.
Right, and you would think that this starts an adventure sequence, right, about the daring rescue of Thorstein's daughter.
You'd like to think that, wouldn't you? But Thorstein and Carl just set sail for Iceland shortly after. No mention of trying to find
him. Oh, nice. Nice.
Well, I mean, there's no trace of him. What are they supposed to do?
Uh-huh.
Where could she possibly
dust for ship prints.
Yeah. They also, John, they had their trip planned. You know, are they supposed to just interrupt their plans? Now, sadly,
it's so hard to get a refund on your tickets.
That's right. Now, very sadly for Gudrun Thorarna or whatever she is called, Snækol keeps her captive and has two children with her, who we are going to meet a little later in the next episode.
It's a tragic story for her, and she's hardly the only woman who will be treated poorly in this saga. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a theme that we have to pick up in a future episode.
Yeah. Now, meanwhile, Thorstein and Carl arrive in Iceland, and as the Lanama book suggests, they are greeted by Helgi the Lean, who's the leading man in the district of Eyjafjord. They stay with him for the winter and then settle on some land near another chieftain called Ljotolf, who lives at Hof. Now, Ljotolf watches these newcomers with interest, but he harbors some resentments toward them that eventually erupt into violence. And then the saga picks up after the Lacuna in the middle of an unsuccessful ambush arranged by Ljótolf to deal with Thorstein the Red, and Carl the Red.
Right. Picks up just in time, by the way, to add 17 bodies to the body count.
I was very
saga.
Pleased that it did that.
Most convenient for us, if somewhat inconvenient for the families and loved ones of those 17
that's
people.
Right. Oh, well.
Good. So that's a very thorough précis. That catches us right up.
It does.
And according to this version, the Thorstein of this post-Lacuna section is the same Thorstein as the one we've been dealing with so far.
He is. He is indeed. How do you feel about that, John?
I mean, I'm neutral on it, honestly. The story does follow the typical formula of a saga, so I guess it makes sense that this could be the same Thorstein.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it does. I like if whether Rask made this up or whether he found the missing pages that tell the story, it hits the right notes for me, but there are other possibilities.
Here we go.
Well, Frederick Heinemann, our translator, argues that it makes sense to think of this Thorstein of this half of the story as the son of Thorstein Thorgnirson from the first half.
Okay, and that's based on what exactly?
Kind of based on a structureless analysis of the text. He's got a theoretical four-part structure that he proposes for this saga. And it really is reflecting his interest in highlighting the negative attitudes towards Swedes in the saga.
Okay, because if Thorstein Svarvath is Thorstein's son, then his mother would be the Swedish Ingibjörg.
Exactly. And the assumption going forward, I guess, would be that the Thorstein of the second half of the saga isn't as effective or isn't as good a person as what we saw in the first part. So there's got to be a different, he's got to be a different guy. What do you think? Does that make sense?
I mean, there is a logic to it. I'm not convinced by it for any number of reasons. It is very narratively satisfying to think of this as a father-son that is then sort of mirrored in another father-son combination that we're going to meet later on in the saga. That's very neat, and it does fit that structuralist idea. The biggest problem I have with it is there's a lot of context for this story that suggests a fairly large jump in time. It definitely doesn't fit with Thorstein being the same guy both times. I'm not sure we even jump forward enough if Thorstein is Thorstein's son. And I suppose to get to Thorstein's son, we'd have to make some kind of logic about what happened to the original Thorstein.
Yeah. Heinemann assumes that Thorstein died in right. Norway, and then his son kind of moves on to Iceland when Harald Fairhair shows up.
Right, but then this would almost have to be that the original Thorstein dies before Thorstein's born.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know
because that's usually the only way you'd end up with a guy named Thorstein Thorsteinsson.
Yeah, I mean that's really my problem because you know I'm not really buying this as Thorstein's son, if only because I have this thing about Icelandic saga naming traditions, and in most of the sagas that we've read, fathers don't typically name their sons after themselves, right? And I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it is unusual. They name their sons after their own fathers or the fathers of their wives or after their brothers, et cetera, et cetera. So if we're going to accept that this is a different Thorstein from the coal-biter hero of the first part, then I would argue it's his grandson. But I don't know if I'm happy with that either.
Yeah. Now, in terms of naming traditions, I agree. That sounds right. But that means I have to ask, do you believe that this is Thorstein's grandson?
I don't know, man. I mean, you're right that there might be the sense that a lot of time has passed, but I don't see that. I mean, there's nothing in the first part to indicate when it is, and there's nothing in the second part to indicate when it is. So it could all be of a piece. It's not unusual to have a story of a single character who has this kind of like fantastic origin story. And then he comes to Iceland when things get a little rough in Norway. To me, that kind of works. So I'm inclined to, if you put me on the spot, after reading Rask's version of things, I'm inclined to think this is the same Thorstein. He just feels different from the Thorstein that we've grown to love because he's the Thorstein of a completely different version of the saga.
Right. That to me is the ultimate answer. Whether this is the same Thorsten or a subsequent Thorsten, almost is the wrong question to be asking.
Yeah.
What we really should be asking is whether the first Thorsten is the same as any character, present or past, in this second half of the saga.
Right.
Right. That it's a different story with different assumptions, different preoccupations, different agendas. And the characters are shaped to fit that.
That's right.
And so ultimately, this is a different Thorsten, even if it's the same Thorsten.
That's a good way of putting it. All right.
All right, fair enough. I think we've blathered on long enough here.
Okay. All right. Well, we did it, John. We stepped up to that big lacuna. We peered into its dank and murky depths. And we traversed the perilous gap without losing our souls.
Speak for yourself. But here we are on the other side, ready to start what appears to us both, I think we've agreed on this, to be an entirely different saga. But the same saga.
If not entirely different, at least a variant, whatever.
Right. Potato, tomato.
Right. Either way, this is all very exciting, isn't it?
Practically on pins and needles, Andy.
Okay, well then why stop here? We're only like 45 minutes in or so. Let's forge ahead. Let's record the next episode now. Let's just go. Let's see who this Thorsten is. Let's see what he's all about.
No.
Huh.
Well, not tonight, but soon. Soon. I will, however, allow for one quick RuneSack question, if you've got one.
A quick RuneSack question, you say? Quick. Is that possible?
Yes. We'll see.
Hmm. All right, well, I do have one.
Okay, let's go for it. I've got at least one or two brain cells left. It's a Friday evening. We can squeeze my last few brain cells. I don't need them for the next couple of days. Let's use it on a rune sack.
All right, well, this rune stick comes from Jason Eisler.
Does it now?
It does. And he carved an interesting question for us on this stick here. I believe it says, what's a lacuna?
it's a missing piece of a manuscript or book.
That's right. So there you go, Jason. A missing piece of a
manuscript. See, that was easy. Book. That was nice and short.
Yeah, and with that, I believe we're done for now.
What a ridiculous episode this
was.
So we just full on hit pause on our summary and discussion in the middle of a saga, just so we could mess around with a part of the saga that's not there.
But we did it. We crossed the treacherous lacuna. Here we are on the other side, making our way again, ready to get into the story.
There you go. Quipping and japing like ever.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure we'd make it, honestly.
Yeah, well, I assume we lost a few listeners along the way, which is too bad, but, you know.
Well, it's a dangerous business, this saga thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll be back next time with the start of Svarfdala Saga Part 2. Svarfdala Saga.
Now with more Svarfdal.
Well, I mean, any Svarfdal would be more at this point.
Yeah, there wasn't any in the first part.
No, there hasn't been any yet. There's a whole lot of action and intrigue coming your way, and we promise, no more discussion of manuscript studies.
You just had to sneak that in one more time.
Also, we don't actually promise that. There probably will be some.
Well, remember how we said a while ago that this is one of the more disturbing sagas? Well, all of that starts up in the next episode.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a good thing.
It's a saga thing.
Cute. That's very clever.
You did it, so I thought I would
do it. In the meantime, reach out to us on social media or on our Discord page if you want to share your response to this episode.
Yeah. Do you think that Thorsten is Thorsten, or is he Thorsten Thorstenson, or is he Thorsten Thorstenson's son?
And how do you feel about Rask's effort to fill in the blanks? Did he really find those pages? Did he make it all up? Is it just 19th century scholar Mad Libs?
Yeah. All of our social media contacts and a link to the Discord are in the show notes. So go ahead and get involved in the conversation with one of those or all of them. But if social media isn't your thing and you want to reach out to us the old-fashioned way, well, you can reach us at sagathingpodcast@gmail.com.
And if you want to go really, really old-fashioned, write your question down, hide it somewhere in Iceland, and hope that a clever soul like Rasmus Rask can find it and deliver it to us, or at least make it up as he goes along.
Kind of like a rune stick Easter egg hunt.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah, and if you've made it all the way through this episode, even though it's shorter than our usual, we thank you very much for your attention and for listening. Until next time.
Bye for now.
That was a jolly good old time. I get it, though. Now I get it. It's funny on paper.
So, you know, oddly enough, that's going to be on my tombstone.
Is that right?
He was funnier on paper.